My guest today is the prodigiously talented young actor Papa Esiedu, a man who almost begun his career with Hamlet. We discussed Desert Island Zooms, Black Lives Matter, and bringing Shakespeare to the masses, and it was my utter pleasure to spend an hour with him.
Yes, it's true.
How's it going?
Yeah, I'm not too bad. I'm sorry. I think I was in the wrong waiting room.
I don't even know how that works.
I don't even know how that's possible.
How many people can be in a waiting room at the same time?
I think it's actually limitless. It's a brave new world.
Okay, if you were to be in a Zoom waiting room with anyone, top five picks. Let's begin with that.
Is this like a budget Desert Island Inn?
Yeah, it is. It's for the COVID generation. Just right. You're in an internet waiting room. The screen is black. You don't get to see them, but you just feel their presence. Who are they?
Oh wow! So it's really about aura, right?
Yeah.
The audio goes off.
The audio, everything's off. It's like you're free floating through the outermost reaches of the cosmos, but you know they're there. Who are they?
The cherished ones. I've got to say. Maybe, so like, let's take someone from every industry. I'd take like a historic footballer, like, Zinedine Zidane.
That would have been my pick. I'm obsessed with Zinedine Zidane.
He's got such a perfectly shaped head, doesn't he?
He's so relentlessly beautiful.
In every way, spiritually, the way he moves, the way he talks, the way everything.
It just radiates strength. And calm.
No one's ever seen him smile. Which would be great for a Zoom waiting room, because you could be naked and no one would know.
Smiles are wasted in a Zoom waiting room.
Who would you have?
Who would I have? Ooh, from sport. Well, sport at the moment, I'd probably have...
Marcus Rashford.
Exactly. I'd have Marcus Rashford. Yeah. And to be honest, I think he... I'd have him for it'd be a good 5 years before anyone's going to knock him off the top spot.
Yeah, he's got a lot in the bank now, hasn't he?
Beloved in a heartbeat. I mean, because I don't follow football in a tribal way, so I don't really have a team as such. But I support the national team. Yeah. He's always beloved.
Oh, poor you.
Because he's amazing. I don't get into the pettiness. Ah, he's this, he's that. And then he does that, and it's like... Yeah, he's. I think even if it's just Marcus Rashford in the Zoom waiting room.
I think he's got enough personality to make up for the other four and more, I'd say.
From the theatre, maybe
someone like Mark Rylance. Do you know what I mean?
Have you worked with him?
I've never worked with him, no. But like, he's kind of like every like drama school kid's wet dream. Do you know what I mean? Like, if you mention that name in any drama school in this country, you see like these students like dissolve into giggling fits in a way that doesn't really happen with the general public. But he's like, he's the kind of epitome of theatre acting. You know, he's like, he's one of those guys who can kind of transform space into something quite otherworldly. I mean, I saw him do Jerusalem like 10 years ago. I saw it like four times or something. So
he just, he's a cut above, isn't he? Yeah. He's got that Zidane thing here. He's got power with sort of quietude. He doesn't do the Pacino, look at me, jazz hands, let's choose some scenery. I'm here, guys.
I mean, it's understated, but he has still got a very loud voice.
It's a bit of a boomer in a theatre environment, but you just buy into everything. Yeah. All right, so Rylance for theatre. Your choices are impeccable, by the way. Music.
Can I go into? Is it like Dead or Alive, or do I have to?
No, it's your waiting room. It's an intergalactic waiting room. You pick.
It's got to be Ray Charles, right?
I love Ray Charles. Do you know what? I haven't even thought about Ray Charles for 2-3 years.
I was watching the... have you seen the Quincy Jones documentary on Netflix? Came out like maybe a year ago.
I haven't seen it.
Amazing. And it kind of follows Quincy Jones's life, I guess. And like, you realise that guy has been like a legend of American music, or world music, I guess. since like the 50s. Do you know what I mean? So like he's a big name in the 50s. So he's talking about like life in the 50s. And anyway, he was like a 18, 20, 20 whatever year old guy playing with Ray Charles, you know. So like I had to go back into his back catalogue and it's just, again, impeccable.
I'm gonna revisit. I have to say I had one of the most shameful episodes of my life in relation to Ray Charles, which was I don't know if you remember, you might be too young, they did Stars in Their Eyes. So you basically, you tonight, Matthew, I'm going to be.
You weren't Ray Charles, were you?
That would have been spectacularly inappropriate. But no, Linford Christie was Ray Charles. And even that was spectacularly inappropriate because he was slightly doing the blind swaying.
You don't want to see that.
No.
I don't want to see that.
Although I don't even know where to go with the fact that there was a slight suggestion from you that I might have gone to Ray Charles.
Hey, I don't want to put boundaries on you or your historical choices.
Listen, my insides are fused together in a kind of like, I get this thing, I don't know if you get this, but you're probably much more morally clean than I am. But, you know, I just think, now you've said that, I think, did I do that? I'm so desperate to not be any of these terrible things.
That's why people like clean out their Facebooks from like way back when, because there's skeletons in a lot of closets out there.
If someone was to do a full sweep of your social,
yeah,
what would they find? Have you been on point, or have there been moments of historic lapses? I think. I had a historical lapse of racism.
You know what? I think I'd actually be like quite unremarkable. I'm not really that big on social media, especially not on expressing or sharing my own thoughts or views. So. And I've never really been like that either. And especially not at that, because the dangerous point is that kind of like maybe like 17 to 22 years old type thing where you're still in the kind of mindset of wanting to say something sensational to impress like a girl across the playground. Just it's on the internet now and it's there for posterity and
everyone. And borderline stalky and Oh, that's good, you missed out on that. Very strong.
I think I've been quite lucky in that aspect.
But whereas most, like, as you say, in that age range, you know, people are sort of still sort of emotionally in the playground, you're in the foothills of starting to play Hamlet. This is insane. It's insane. You almost, you didn't start your career like that, but maybe the most, it's a thing that people perhaps remember you first for doing.
Yeah, maybe so. Yeah, I was 20. I was 25, which is like, I suppose, relatively young in terms of like how I guess famous people do it in this country, because like often like more famous people that have done it have been a bit older, like David Tennant or Michael Sheen or Cumberbatch or whoever.
But yours is more age appropriate because Hamlet is.
Do you know what I mean? I think it's definitely a reading, and like for me, like. That play is so much about like a young man's response to grief.
Yeah.
No, it's like, and like Shakespeare himself is writing, having, I think, just lost his 3-year-old child or something like that. So he's really kind of like in the throes of grief. So like, that's how the play speaks to me, at least. So it didn't feel inappropriate in terms of the performing of it, but I guess in terms of like having that weight on my shoulders or like the weight of expectation, it was a bit of a new one.
I mean, it's sort of like a career upside down, because people move towards Shakespeare kind of late on, don't they? They kind of go, well, I'm gonna just do some new work, some contemporary stuff, and then maybe, you know, I get a little bit old in the chops, I'm gonna smash out a couple of big wills. But it's like but that's what's great, is the fact that is for me your Hamlet is so much closer, I think, to a proper Shakespearean reading. It's like impetuousness and trying to put controls and brakes on this huge sort of tsunami of rage and grief, as you say, and upset. And the control he tries to put on it is very much a young person's response, rather than somebody older just going, this is going to be shit for a bit, I'm going to let it wash over me. And just
I think so. And like, you've got to remember that Shakespeare, like, he writes his plays to be performed. He doesn't necessarily write them to be read and studied and analyzed and dissertationed. He writes his plays for actors to perform. So they're very active and they're very full of like physical like, expansion and emotion, et cetera, et cetera. So I guess like, yeah, it is a bit upside down for me. And like, also I never grew, I hated Shakespeare when I was at school, for example, like as so many kids do. I kind of remember studying Romeo and Juliet and hating both of them passionately, not understanding why they were thought of as the greatest lovers of all time. They both sounded like the worst people. Like in terms of playground politics, no one's doing anything right in that play.
No.
So I also came to Shakespeare for me, I guess, relatively late. So it's weird that you kind of like come in contact with a body of work and fall in love with it and want to explore it. So I've been very fortunate to have been given opportunities to do that.
I think sort of I didn't really get Romeo and Juliet until I saw West Side Story. Or, you know, sometimes you need to get into the into Shakespeare through just a different way of
Yeah,
expressing it, which is
I love,
exactly
to be fair, I love the Baz Luhrmann film.
yeah yeah
I absolutely adore that film, and I think there's something not unsophisticated, but it's not precious, it's not up itself. It's just like, again, very kind of like full of hormones, you know?
yeah
It's full of like, and that's what that play's about. It's about like young pubescent like
And it's the drama as
misunderstanding
well.
life.
It's like, do you remember when you, I mean, it's a long, lot further back for me than you, but it's like, I remember I had a fight with my then boyfriend, and it was a slight fight, and I just got so hammered I couldn't stand and lay in the road in a starfish shape, sort of crying and stopping traffic in the middle of Croydon over nothing. It was just all me and the drama. And that's what Romeo and Juliet is. It's like, I'm going to drink some poison. It's such a
Exactly.
fucking teenage posture, isn't
Yeah,
it?
I think the starfish in the road will definitely be used for some university production of it someday soon.
Are you anxious or stressed or struggling to focus? Well, who isn't right now? But you can bring new calm to your day with Grass & Co. CBD. Grass & Co. is a premium CBD range that blends the highest quality CBD with therapeutic botanical ingredients. I've tried them. In fact, I've tried all of them, and they are properly brilliant. The great tasting CBD and botanical formulations have been specially created to relax your mind and soothe that body. Find your lockdown calm with grassandco.com. People who've already tried CBD, or at least some of them, think that the challenging taste of the oil is something you have to put up with to enjoy the benefits. But these oils from Grass & Co. taste fantastic. Their CBD is blended with organic botanical ingredients, including ginger, turmeric, orange, ashwagandha, chamomile, and mint for the most delicious and smooth flavours. To find out more, just head over to grassandco.com/hour. If you're new to CBD, the best-selling 500 milligrams calm CBD oil is a great jumping off point. As with all supplements, CBD does affect everyone differently, so start low and steadily build your dosage every day so that you find the balance that works with your body. Grass & Co. CBD products deliver exactly what you need when you need it, whether it's first thing in the morning to prepare for a busy day at work, or in the evening when the calm body oil is ideal after a relaxing bath, along with a calm candle to help you unwind before bed. Listeners to this podcast can get 25% off and free shipping. So just head over to www.grassandco.com/hour. Simply use the discount code HOUR at checkout to claim 25% off the entire Grass & Co. Calm, Ease and Rest CBD ranges. Grass & Co. Life enhanced by nature. We're recording at a time where Ep 4 of I May Destroy You has gone out.
Right.
And I just, it's an extraordinary piece of work. It's an extraordinary piece of work. And I
Absolutely.
wanted to talk a bit about Ep 4 is obviously a very pivotal episode for you. You know, if three episodes exploring consent around Michaela's character. And then suddenly we land on Kwame, who you play. And I have to say, it was one of the most extraordinary half hours of television I've seen, not only because it explores consent between gay men, but also within the context of the black community. Mm. Even that exchange you have with this sort of tentative, slightly older guy who can't reach out to you and can't express his gayness. It's just, it was so moving, and it's just turned the dial, I can't tell you. Because you just don't see it, do you? You just don't see that.
Yeah, it's strange. I guess it's strange to me that that's radical for us to be putting that on our screens, because, I mean, yeah, it's a conversation about consent, but there's a conversation about, there has to be a conversation about consent whenever there's a conversation about sex. And we don't, I mean, we need not to, at least. We don't see sex through a binary lens, or we shouldn't see sex through a binary lens. So sex has got all sorts of actualities along a spectrum, and therefore so does consent. So it's, I guess it's sad that it's taken till now to kind of start exploring it in quite a frank way, which I think is done through the show, and actually, like, and not particularly on the nose way. I think it's like it comes out through the story and through the characters and their relationships. But yeah, the fact that it's radical is sad, but it's important, you know, and the response to it has been incredible.
You've talked before and about the fact that there was an intimacy coordinator. Mm. So Ita, who did your intimacy coordination, it also strikes me as very strange that that's not been something standard in film and television work from the get-go. Yeah. This is a very, very new thing, isn't it? That you have someone there who will basically choreograph the way that you two have faked sexual contact. So how does that actually work?
Well, I mean, it's very similar to, well, I mean, for example, on films, plays, TV shows, there's been fight coordinators for a long time, you know, and any time you see, or stunt coordinator, for example. So anytime you see a stunt or a fight in a show, there's someone who's employed to make sure that's done properly, I guess for insurance purposes, to make sure like Antonio Banderas doesn't poke someone's eye out with his Zorro sword or whatever. But it's just seen as standard. It's necessary. You can't do it without one. The idea that up until recently, people have kind of just been like blagging their way through really intimate, really difficult scenes that kind of, yeah, like you say, simulate sexual scenarios is insane to me. So it's a similar kind of thing. Like, we all spend time before we start shooting talking about the scene, talking about what our boundaries are, what we feel comfortable doing, figuring out a way to allow the scene to be truthful but without anyone to feel unsafe or feel like they're zones have been infringed upon, you know. And then when we actually come to shooting the scene, that's the thing that's put out as a massive priority. Like, we've got to like look after our performers, especially in this in a show where we're talking about consent.
Yeah.
Like, it's important that the performers consent to what they're doing before we even think about the viewers like engaging with the themes of consent.
But I can't tell you how many actors I know from, you know, who've been working for years now, who haven't had any intimacy coordination. So they've gone into scenes, that guy's just shove the tongue down the throat.
Yeah.
No questions asked, no discussion beforehand. It's just, you know, they've been pushed about, they've been, you know, and it's been, you know, sometimes a really sort of unwarranted and aggressive sort of sexual simulation that's just gone too far.
Yeah.
And the actor has always been able to then say, well, just in the moment, or, you know, I was just in character.
Yeah, that's the messed up thing about it. The idea that, because that's what, for me, that's what allows people to abuse, like, power or like those kind of dynamics, because the idea that like good acting or like in the moment acting or taking risks or whatever is equated with being able to like I suppose like dominate someone else or like do something without someone's permission is just like such an unsafe space to find yourself in, you know. Because then you start thinking, if I'm not like giving myself to this, that means I'm bad, or that means I'm not doing my job as an actor, and I might not get rehired, or I might not, people might not think I'm good, or whatever. And that kind of is the case, or from like the smallest like Amdram play to the biggest film set, you know. we kind of like value this idea of like the maverick and like, oh my god, who knows what he or she's going to do next, you know? And that's messed up because it doesn't look after people. So yeah, to me it's mad
I think that is the attitude of people who are, you know, rising up now in their sort of 20s and sort of early 30s in the business. I think, as I say, even a year ago, you know, 2 years ago perhaps, that just didn't exist. And as you say, it's really interesting that idea of the maverick, you know, this we enshrined within acting culture. So there are so many dangerous stereotypes. As you say, there's always with the person who's in his methoding, who'll drink too much or take loads of coke because their character takes loads of coke. And then suddenly you've got this sort of tyrannical, wild, crazy person on set. And everyone's frightened of them, but no one can say anything because they are the star and they're always in character. I mean, I know people have just sort of saying it on, you know, on set. There'd be people, you know, actors talking in completely different accents, never using their own voice. It's just weird and intimidating for everyone else who's just trying to do a good job.
Yeah, I think so. And for me, it's egotistical, and it kind of like demeans like the idea that, especially on screen projects, to make a film or to make a TV show requires the expertise of so many different people outside of actors. You know, like the idea. I think the idea that actors, like you, that actors kind of like a great performance makes a film. It's just like so absurd once you've actually been on a set, you know, once you see like the amount of technical ability in like someone who works, who's a sound operator or who's a costume designer, who's a makeup artist or a grip or like, or a rigger or whatever. It's just like, there are so many people on a set who do jobs that I have absolutely no idea how to do. And the average person has absolutely no idea how to do. Whereas how many people can kind of like, stand in a funny costume and speak in a funny way, quite a few, you know. So we need to think about how we value people in the grand scheme of things.
Do you think that your relentlessly non-precious attitude is to do with the fact that, which I thoroughly approve of, by the way, is that you weren't seemingly? I mean, you weren't that interested in being an actor for a long time. You were on the precipice of pursuing a completely different life.
Yeah. I was gonna do medicine. I was gonna be a doctor. I was brought up by my mum, who's first generation Ghanaian immigrant, and like as anyone. All people who come from those kind of backgrounds know that the kind of only three options you get are like to either be a doctor or a lawyer or like a, I don't know, accountant or whatever. So it was never my dream. I never went to like stage school or like youth theatre clubs or anything like that. It was all very late in the day for me. And like, especially for a long time, I just, number one, didn't think I was very good, and really, being honest, probably wasn't very good, you know? So like, I didn't come from a place of being like the best in the class or like whatever. So it's always for me been about kind of like trying to observe other people and thinking about and try to figure out why I'm drawn to that performer or I'm drawn to that film or that scene or whatever, and trying to use that to learn and improve. Which has allowed me to kind of have this attitude now, I think.
So what was the thing, what was the tipping point? I might only say that it wasn't your passion to perform, but there must have been some addictive, adrenalised moment where you thought, right, okay.
I guess all actors have this moment where they first do it and you get that kind of buzz. I think I just did like a school play because there was a girl I fancied and there I did this little bit. I was playing like a postman or something. I had like two lines or something, but I did this little bit by accident almost, and the audience laughed, right? And there's something, I think, if that's like drug, like that's a bit like a high, as I'm sure you know.
Very, very rarely, as it turns out, but I cling to those moments, those rare moments. And did you get the girl in the end?
I can't even remember who the girl was, to be fair. But,
you heartbreaker.
I almost definitely did not. but I've got a semblance of a career, so it wasn't a complete
failure. It turned out pretty well. We've gone into, I mean, I'm sort of really mindful that anyone who works in the arts has gone into lockdown in one, you know, leaving one world, and they're facing a completely changed one as they come out. We don't know whether theatres will survive. We don't know, you know, at the moment they're not being bailed out. We don't know if there's a sort of political, ideological push to sort of let the arts flounder. But it's got to be very strange for someone like you who's worked so much in the theatre and for whom you're obviously, you know, waiting on jobs to start up again filming.
Yeah, I think it's terrifying, really, especially because, you know what, I kind of think the TV and film industry will kind of be fine, you know, like I think they will always have like investment that will look after them, and also they're not kind of dependent on the same income route as theatres are. Theatres need audiences in close proximity, really, to be able to exist in the way that they have been for hundreds of years, and that's just not going to be possible for a long while, and theatres are not going to be able to survive for a long time unless there's an intervention. And I think it's the responsibility of the government to do that, because if we talk about the film industry or the television industry, and we think about where those writers come from, where those actors come from, where those directors come from, they all come, especially in this country, 80-90% of them come through the theatre. And if we're thinking about like how we've been keeping ourselves alive through, like, mentally at least, through lockdown, we've all been on Netflix or Amazon or whatever. Like, the pipeline towards that comes through the theatre. It's the lifeblood of that industry, and if it's not looked after and cared for, it will die, and the knock-on effect on that will be devastating. So it's just like, it's just so crucially important.
And also, that's, you know, a time where people are rather belatedly focusing on diversity in the media.
Yeah.
If that lifeline's cut off, then TV and radio will remain sort of preserved in a kind of white aspect, will it not?
I think so. And I mean, like, in the context of the global political situation at the moment, it's interesting because, like, it kind of encourages people to think of this as some sort of crisis point, as if, like, these conversations have just come out in the last kind of month or so. And to me, that's, like, incredibly disrespectful and ignorant of the plights of so many Black and brown people for years, decades, centuries now, you know? So I think if we are to continue making any sort of directions towards progressive work artistically, culturally, it needs that kind of investment to make it happen.
But it's so grassroots. I'm really struck by the fact that you say when you were growing up there were no drama schools, youth centres, you know, and you in the inner cities particularly, and particularly amongst first second generation immigrant population, there's no play, you know what I mean? There's no spaces to develop creativity, imagination, whether it's expressed through music or dance or drama. Yeah.
Well, I mean, the places are there, they're just not funded,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And they can't be, you can't put all, because I mean, so I grew up in Walthamstow, which is in East London. Closest theatre to me is probably Stratford East, which is, I don't know, 5 miles away or something. Stratford East is an amazing theatre run by an amazing woman called Nadia Fall, and it's got an incredible kind of like connection to its community and its youth. But it can't have the responsibility for taking care artistically of every child in the 10-kilometre radius. It's impossible, you know? And that's, again, about funding. It's about, it kind of, for me, it all comes down to public funding of and looking after, like, our future generations in terms of their imaginations, in terms of their cultural, like, expression. And that comes through music, that comes through theatre, comes through sport, whatever, you know? But, like, austerity, I think, has been the biggest killer to any of that.
Yeah, I totally agree. And in times of austerity, the people who live in status quo flourish, and the people that, you know, are in the margins and have been left behind or disenfranchised will wither on the vine, and that's what's happened. And so you're right, the Black Lives Matter movement seems to be, it's a flashpoint in what has been a centuries long disenfranchisement. that's just suddenly, it's almost got some media attention and big brands have jumped on. And I wonder how you feel about that. You know, there's the kind of the way that actually long held sentiments being kind of co-opted by sponsors almost.
Yeah, again, really messed up, you know. So like, for me, like like I said earlier on, I've been trying to like be quite judicious on my engagement with social media of late, just in terms of like my own self-care routine. But like, I remember seeing the NFL commissioner releasing a statement about how the NFL stands in solidarity with the blacks, with their black players and Black Lives Matter movement. And it's the same person for which the whole taking a knee gesture was targeted towards, you know? So like, again, like the idea of that being co-opted and actually being capitalized upon is a continuation of the kind of like exploitation of the disenfranchised. So it's an amazing moment for protest, and it's an amazing moment for underrepresented voices being amplified, but it's also like super messed up in terms of like people shamelessly using it for their own advancements and kind of using it as a kind of varnish of so-called progressiveness.
I find it also an example of just intense ignorance and gaslighting. So today, the day that we're speaking, the foreign secretary has assumed that taking the knee comes from Game of Thrones. And for my self-care, I had to stay off Twitter for the whole day because I will say things that will come back to bite me, because the fury that I feel about that level of either ignorance or provocation, I don't know what it is. And maybe it's a kind of fetid mixture of both of them, I don't know. But then also the conflation of the Black Lives Matter movement with what then followed with the fascists basically urinating by statues and Hitler saluting. And that's just me on the sidelines as a very privileged white girl. You know, I don't even know what levels of self-care you must need in order to make that tolerable.
I think like right now that black people in this country, our biggest responsibility to ourselves are of self-care and of self-love and self-preservation, because we're surrounded by images and gestures that suggest that black lives do not matter, as well as having the responsibility of communicating to people that they do. You know, it's a lot to take on, and that trauma and that pain can only be tolerated so far, you know? And yeah, I mean, similarly to you, like I kind of think, wow, so Dominic Raab, he's a foreign secretary, isn't he? Right, so he's our representative in the world, right?
To the Commonwealth, to the nations of Africa,
Right, before we even go into like, before we even start unpacking what that means. I kind of find it impossible I don't find it useful to kind of assume that it's an accidental kind of gaffe, you know, like I can't think of it as anything other than intentional ignorance. And that's bad for my mental health to engage with that and to kind of like trust that person to represent me. He never will.
No, I think that I wish I had an ounce of your self-preservation actually. This episode of the podcast is sponsored by Gymshark. Gymshark are a conditioning brand dedicated to creating functional training apparel, designing innovative performance technologies and building passionate, empowered communities. Formed in a garage in Birmingham in the UK, Gymshark has emerged as a leading brand in the industry with a worldwide family of over 15 million people in 150 countries. They exist to unite the conditioning community. Gymshark's functional training apparel is perfect for whatever your fitness regime is. From flex leggings and seamless sports bras to the hoodies and track tops, the Gymshark catalogue feels great and looks great too. You can check it out for yourself now at gymshark.com/Sue Perkins. Gymshark also work with creators and athletes such as extreme athlete Ross Edgley, who was the first man to swim around Great Britain. Well, you don't have to be as extreme as Ross to enjoy the Gymshark clothing. I sit watching TV and mine is perfect. Gymshark are creating a community devoted to unlocking potential, united by conditioning. To learn more, check out their website at gymshark.com/Sue Perkins. I mean, you've had a lot of grief and bereavement in your life and you've managed to come I mean, one never comes through it. I don't mean to belittle that experience. You live with it, you live alongside it, but you seem to have lived alongside it with an incredible degree of calm and maturity.
Yeah, I mean, this is today, you know, like...
Tomorrow you're going to lose your shit.
One day maybe, but also the journey of grief is a long journey and it kind of like has many faces and many stages, you know, so like I'm able to speak about it with a level of articulacy now that I wouldn't have been able to do even a year or 2 years ago, you know, so I feel grateful to have had the relationships and loves that I've had in my life, and I still, like you say, I still hold on to them in a very real way, and yeah, it's part of my journey of maturation and progression, I guess, to continue trying to, I suppose, digest that and use it to help forge the kind of person that I want to be in the future.
I think what's interesting about the role of an actor is that lots of people will look at actors and go, oh God, you know, they're trying to change the world. And there's that, you know, I always think of Team America and the way that they just blast, you know, kind of liberal do-gooder actors.
Yeah.
How can you, when you're being somebody else, communicate, you know, but kind of raise the vibrational level of the planet, if you know what I mean? How do you go about doing that? Is it just simply through the roles that you pick? The same with Kwame, you know, roles that shine a light on a new, unexplored level of society.
Yeah, I mean, you can get wanky or you cannot get wanky when it comes to the power of art to change lives or to affect people. But like, there's a reason that millions of people watch television every day. There's a reason why millions of people watch films. Millions of people watch plays. You know, because we need that kind of like mirror to our own lives, and we desire those kind of like challenges and questions, and we desire like someone to say it's okay to talk about this because I've seen it there, you know. Yeah. Like I do feel like my responsibility as an artist is political, but like not in a kind of idealistic kind of like divorced way. Yeah, I do feel it's just by like doing my job with like as much authenticity and passion and application as I can do. I think it's the collaboration of all of those things leads to the vibrations that you talk of being raised.
I got some serious vibrations watching Gangs of London. I'm going to be really honest with you. I'm doing it in bite-sized chunks. I'm an old bird now, and the ticker can't take it. And I'm like, I watch like 20 minutes, and I'm thinking, this is really intense. And then suddenly there's a dude that's just covered in blood, like he's just covered in blood in a warehouse, in a pair of pants and some wellies with a cleaver. And I'm like, this is intense. There's a fight scene for 15 minutes where I think I'm going to vomit. Just as that's done, you think, little breather. Straight into the next sort of slitty, gory, hangy. I mean, it's an amazing show. It's got the energy that it kind of creates in the video. It's terrifying. But underneath, again, that's the part that you play, Alex, who's the sort of the dynastic successor, isn't he? He's the young, he's the son, he's about to inherit. It, again, is a very interesting political part. It's an interesting choice, that, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I think, and like, you're not, by the way, you're not alone in kind of like worrying about your ticket and watching that show. Like, even because we filmed it maybe like 2 years ago, so I'd actually forgotten what it was all about. So when I actually rewatched it, I was watching it like a punter, and like, trust me, my nightmares were stressful. I didn't sleep for about a fortnight, you know. So even from the inside, it's hard. But yeah, the thing about Alex and I suppose my character and Joe Cole's character, Sean. It's looking at generational progression and like this idea of aspiration and this idea of like turning up in a country where I suppose the general populace is violent towards you or rejecting towards you. There's this kind of like historical thing on pub doors and letting flat doors of no blacks, no Irish, no dogs, you know? So like, it's the idea of like going from that to the idea of being able to have something and have a lot of something and to anchor yourself in legitimacy within the period of 25, 30 years, you know, that's a short period of time for there to be like quite a seismic shift. So I think that's what our characters are about. We're about looking at a new way of living that that is very different from our parents. And there's a kind of parallel, I think, with a lot of generational differences in this country that perhaps have like maybe less like blood and meat cleavers, but like you know, it's a story that I think a lot of second generation children will relate to.
Yeah, it's. I was just thinking about that thing you were saying about, you know, children of immigrants. You know, they sort of grow up thinking, well, I've got to be a doctor, and second, you know, then a lawyer maybe. I remember being in the sort of back streets of Mexico, and with a Haitian family, and they were basically, they had a spare room, and so any Haitians that came up as part of the human caravan that was coming up through from Venezuela and Haiti and, you know, El Salvador, they would take in families. And there was this fabulous young girl, she was about 23, and she just given birth, newborn baby boy, I mean, like maybe 2 days old, and she was sat with him and I was sort of chatting away, and she said something, and we got the translation back, and she was patting this little kid's head, and she said, "He is going to be a doctor." And I was just crying with laughter. It's just like, you have represented the cliche but also the reality, this is the thing, they exist in both worlds. It's true as well as hackneyed.
Yeah.
Give the kid a break, he's barely drawn breath, he's barely out your belly, and it's like
baby stethoscope round his neck, like
scrubs hat, little mask and everything. It's like, God, he can. I guess, you know, your mum would be to, like, you could play a doctor any day of the week, so you can be a doctor, but then, you know, equally, you could
talk to my agent about that.
But it is that, but with Games in London, it is that cliche of the net, not the cliche, but it's the truth, is what I mean, actually. That some people render into cliche, that the first generation is about fire and blood and survival in a very hostile country that's cold and unrelentingly abusive, and the second generation goes, now I get to work, now I understand, I've brought up in this system and I'm going to play it. And there's something about the character, Alex, you play, that's got that, this is business and I'm going to keep a cool head, and I'm just gonna. I see everything. He's like the kind of, he's working the levers, basically.
Yeah, and it's not a desperation, but it's a sureness that we're not going back to what it was. You know, like the only direction we can move is forward. You know, and like he's fortunate in the fact that he's had an education and he's had opportunities that his parents didn't have, and therefore he's got the instruments and the equipment and I suppose the smarts to entrench himself in a way that can last for a long time, you know. And by the end, like, it's kind of like do or die.
I can't even get there yet. Like, so I read, like, my mom was texting me going, you need to wait for, I think it was EP5, it is the most mind-blowing, you know. I thought, I can't we're talking bite size, we're talking a couple of frames, take a breather, and maybe next week I'll, and I know, because it's visually as well, it's, the fight sequence is the best I've seen, it's visually sumptuous, and it basically has, you know, topped New York. You know, London looks better, brassier, bolder than it's ever done.
Yeah, but London's, like, I'm a Londoner, of course I'd say this, but London's the most dynamic city in the world. It's international, it's ancient, it's huge, you know, and it's like visually very, very recognisable. And I don't think we get to see that, at least on a global scale, enough. But yeah, for me, like the obviously it's hyper-violent, but it is, so the series is created by Gareth Evans and Matt Flannery, and they're famous for, or at least I knew them from watching some of their films, their cinema. They've done two films called The Raid and The Raid 2, which I remember watching in cinema, and like I remember thinking, I'm not really into like kung fu movies or action films really, but like there's something about their use of physical language that is just operatic to a scale that's almost beautiful, you know? So it's not kind of pornographic or it's not sensationalized. It's just like very deliberate, and it's a kind of character in itself, and in the way it lends itself to its storytelling.
It's a completely new physical lexicon, isn't it? It's like you don't see bodies moving like that, and it's terrifying that they're moving to an end of really hurting somebody. But there is a poetry to it that's just, you can't take your eyes off it.
Exactly. And I think as human beings, we're either drawn to it or we're kind of like behind our hands, you know, like squealing. But like, it definitely evokes some sort of feeling in us.
But it's very much like you see things like John Wick, and you'll see, you know, oh yeah, he can take out 20 dudes with a pencil. It's a very different sensibility working in Gangs of London. You know, it's not about somebody who's just a, you know, a mercenary and probably sort of slick and wears all the right gear. These are people who are just in a really stressful firm fighting for their lives, basically. It's tooth and claw stuff, isn't it?
Yeah.
I will finish watching it because I really like it, but it will take me about another...
Hey, I mean, take the whole year.
I'm going to have to, because lockdown, I have to take care of my mental health, you know, I have to...
Hey, I would never want you to put that in any danger, so...
How do you do the Zen, though? Do you have stuff, do you have routines? Because everyone has...
I try to... I live with my girlfriend, so I spend time with her, and like we try not to talk about acting or talk about...
So she's an actor as well?
Yeah, so we kind of like try and make space for our life outside of that. But like, I do a lot of yoga. I've started running recently, trying to keep my like body moving. I've started doing puzzles recently. I haven't done any puzzles since I was like...
I love a puzzle.
Eight or something.
What
like
puzzles
that.
Are you doing? And, like,
I've just actually leveled up to 1,000 pieces, you know? I'm sure the listeners are going to love this, but like, I've been kind of like plateaued at 500 pieces for about 6 weeks, and I've got to the point where I just had my birthday the other day. I turned 30.
Congratulations.
Thank you very much. And my friend got me a puzzle that is just see-through plastic. And it's 500 pieces of see-through.
Oh no, that's not fair. That's not right. That's not going to help your mental health.
You know what I mean? But I'm also like, how long is this lockdown going to be?
Fair enough. Have you done the Great Wave? Apparently, the Great Wave is the one, right? You end on.
Oh yeah.
It's 1,500 pieces.
Yeah, that's got to be like if Boris announces this is going to 2022.
Get the Great Wave.
I'll be straight on eBay.
Just to smash it out. God, yeah. I mean, I don't. I have sort of. ADHD, so for me 1,000 pieces, again, that's going to take some time, because especially just of all perspex, I'm like, I'm out of here. I can't make it go immediately. I'm onto something. What's next? What's happening? What's it all like a butterfly? Just can't do it. Can't focus on that. The yoga as well, I find I like Adrienne, right? I've just connected with have you done yoga with Adrienne?
I've done yoga with Adrian, yeah.
She calls you like a sweet angel when it cries, and it makes me realise that there have been gaps in my childhood that I'm asking strangers to fill.
Yeah, I feel like that's a good substitute for £70 an hour therapist, but I think because I can't really do meditation. I find that really difficult. The idea of like sitting still with my thoughts.
Yeah.
And my eyes closed, I find really difficult. So that's, I suppose, it's the closest thing I can get to that, the kind of like physical movement meditation that yoga.
Can you do the really hard stuff? Are you sort of on, can you do the full yogic? I was going to say yogic flying. I mean, I think that at best is...
Yeah, I think I can do the yogic flying, as they call it.
Can you move through space and time?
Actually not really here. In the Dalai Lama.
While we've been talking, you just nicked to the 18th century and just come back again. You're probably too young, but there was the Natural Law Party, and I think George Harrison got sort of semi-involved as like a participant. Right. So there was some good vibes behind it, if nothing else. And they did a lot of stuff, really serious sort of party political stuff about, you know, mainly we could solve the world's problems if we just yogically flew. And there was a lot of dudes just saying that they got into such an intense trance state during meditation that they, Yeah, it could cross time and space.
I mean, I've seen. Have you seen the?
They got the deposit returned. They didn't make the. didn't work out well for them politically.
But like people about that life, you know. Have you seen that Bhagwan documentary? I can't
remember. Wild Country.
Wild Country, yeah. There's, like, I remember seeing some of the scenes in that of like those like mass kind of, I don't know, trance like experiences. Whereas, like, I mean, from the outside it looks mad, but from the inside that must be kind of transcendental, you know.
I'm obsessed with cults. I mean, I think early doors, if someone said, "Would you like to be one of my wives?" that for me is a red flag. Do you know what I mean? There's no amount of meditation that's going to make me go, there's something off here. Wives, yeah. Plural is the super weird, but wife anyway. But then you add there's multi wives.
Hey, look, polygamy is what it is, but like...
Polygamy is great, but if you're in a compound, right? So you add the compound to it, right? Polygamy is a wonderful thing. If you're into it, knock yourselves out. Love is love. But if you're in a compound and there's a self-styled leader...
Yeah.
Who's getting you to drink some weird-smelling Kool-Aid, I'm saying the chances are high you're in a cult.
Yeah, you might want to get a return train fare. Did you see the Tiger King thing as well?
Do you know what? I really want to, but I can't because I can't bear seeing animals in cages or anyone being cruel to animals.
Absolutely not for you. But there's one bit in that which doesn't really get touched upon about one of the guys in it who also happens to have like four wives or something.
Doc Antles. But I've met him.
Who, you've met him?
So I did a doc about 3-4 years ago. And it was this crazy story about chimpanzees who'd been used to, they'd experimented on basically for years. And they'd taken a load of them from Africa once the AIDS epidemic hit. And they basically just pumped them full of shit in an effort to find a vaccine, which they didn't. And then the federal government very recently went, "This is terrible. Chimps are social creatures. We kept them in isolation. We sent them mad. And instead of studying the effects of medicine on them, we were studying the effects of stress. And so we are now creating enormous sanctuary and we are retiring all laboratory chimps in America." So it's a massive thing. And in one chimp, you get the whole history of man's appalling desecration of landscape and nature. And they said to me, "Right, we're going to focus on this story, but there is another story about pets, about private pets in the States." So I'd done like 2 weeks in Louisiana, which is a very socially and racially divided place and makes you realise that America's troubles are so deep and so... that's a whole other story. And I've done this thing. And then suddenly I'm in Myrtle Beach and I'm with this guy, Doc, and I'm used to the fact that chimps are incredibly dangerous creatures. And as the doorbell, I ring the doorbell, the door opens, right? And there's two chimps that just rush up to me, baby ones, and hang off my neck. I'm shitting myself because they're going to rip my head off. God. And then Doc, who didn't want me to be one of his wives, but he's in a very sort of belly over a very loose pair of cargo pants and some suspicious sandals, just gives me, I'm not joking, like a dog bowl with a load of chimp food in, and sort of sits and makes me eat chimp food with chimps at a dining room table. Now I'm saying this, it sounds really abusive, it probably was. And I'm like, suddenly like, this is not all right. So when I start going, "It's not cool to own private, you know, wild animals." At which point he decides to stop the conversation because he knows it's not going his way. Pisses off, and an hour later, rides an elephant through a suburban back street and into the river. And in the end, the footage wasn't used because it was so mental. And then in the end, the elephant was sort of trumpeting and he was going, "It's calling you, it wants to play." And I go, "I can't play with it, it's a captive element." Elephant, he said, "But it's free and it wants to play with you." So in the end, we all just stripped off our mic pack and threw ourselves in the river and I was on board an elephant.
It's insane that someone's every day, right? That's like... that's
like, "I've got a panther up the road." I said, "You can't say that. You can't say I've got a panther up the road. It's not right." But he just was, he kept basically throwing new animals at me to try and get me to change my mind that what he...
What, so if the chimp won't work, and if the panther won't work, let's try the elephant?
Big birthrat, just get the old elephant there, just do the whole, you know, Disney trumpet. And yeah, so my mates that are working on it, the crew, were like all WhatsApping me when Tiger King came out, going, "You need to..." So he's front and foremost, is he, Doc?
Well, I mean, he's involved. he's like, he, I wouldn't say he's up front and he's front and center, but he's like definitely adjacent. And there is a scene where you see like all of his wives who he makes dress in like tiger themed clothes.
Do you know what's happening with your work landscape next? Because I mean, we know that it's all going to, no one knows when everything's going to start back, but can you talk about what you're up to or what sort of things you're up to?
Yeah, well, I mean, like, yeah, like I say, I suppose like no one really knows what's going to happen with the industry. I think the film and TV industry is probably going to start next, and like I'm meant to be doing a film called Sweet Dreams in like a couple of months, you know. But like, again, like, it's about how do you make a film when you're like not allowed to touch anyone. Like, are you doing your own makeup? If so, I don't think anyone really wants to see that.
You'd be absolutely laughing with no makeup. It's when you get to sort of trollop phase one like me. I mean, the idea that this unvarnished would go on without the old blue circle slathered, that's a bad business. So you'd be doing your own hair and makeup. You'll be doing socially distanced. Also, as well, they can't film in a public space at the moment, so you'll be in a bunker somewhere.
It'll be in like the basement of a travelodge somewhere.
You know? You'd have had to quarantine for a month beforehand.
In the travelodge.
And all the actors will then just hate each other.
And travelodge.
And the travelodge brand by then. Yeah, it'll become, yeah.
Yeah, so I mean, like, that's what I'm meant to be doing, but that's very much a kind of fingers crossed type thing.
And is that filming here or in the States?
That film in here, yeah. So that's like amazing cast, like Ashton Bean, Eve Algar, Billy Howell, Nick Frost, and directed by Carl Tibbetts. So that's really great, and looking forward to that if it happens. But until then, I'm kind of like trying to do as much kind of work with like more like socially directed work as I can. Like, I've been doing some work with a company called Intermission, which kind of like work with kind of like introducing Shakespeare to kids from low income backgrounds. And you know, like, because like it's always like I always feel like, oh, I wish I had more time to do that kind of stuff because I'm passionate about it, and like to be given like a bit of time when there's a lockdown is a kind of blessing in disguise for that. So
where's your starting point for them? Where do you begin with Shakespeare? How do you sell it?
Well, I guess it's from, because the stories are kind of mad, aren't they? Like, everyone loves like a story where like somebody like kills someone else and then pretends to be a woman to get away with it. Or like, you know, there's enough stuff in the actual story. So I think we like
love potions. A lot of love potions going on as well.
Potions, there's a lot of wigs, there's a lot of funny voices, there's a lot of twins, all of that stuff. It's just a basic storytelling, really.
But I mean, Hamlet, for all that it's, you know, it's as we started off saying, it's the big one, isn't it? It's the mountain that no one wants to climb, and you climbed it in your mid-20s. But those, to get a kid to understand that they are closer to Hamlet than any other character almost in Shakespeare, especially if they've gone through grief. And if they're a girl, what I always think, you know, is if Ophelia's grief is so different from Hamlet's grief, and how socially we're channeled into different means of expression through gender, and how twisted that can be, and you know, to get that to a kid, and to say, what is the point of art if, you know, a 16th century bearded white man can't speak to you know, and but also vice versa, if somebody from, you know, Walthamstow, who's second generation Bangladeshi, can't speak to me, then we're all screwed. You just have to find a mechanism that unlocks the similarity, don't you, and the connection.
I guess that's what the accessibility debate is about, because like you can kind of like mystify it so much. And like, for me, like I guess the reason why I hated Romeo and Juliet so passionately is because there's a mystification around it. And I was like, the language is for people who are like, who have read these kind of books and gone to these kind of museums and theatres or whatever, and it's not for people like me, and it never will be for people like me. And like, really, it's like, it's just language, and it's just a kind of means into a story that actually has like very universal themes and can speak to me on a very personal level. So I think it's about allowing yourself to invest in the personal of these stories and trying to communicate that to people. And yeah, I think like you say, it means that there's a more universal communication channel that can be opened up.
I love the fact you're doing that. I hope lockdown does end so that we all get to go and do what we used to do. But also I'm quite glad that you're in lockdown so you get to do that with those kids. Yeah. And you get to, it was a real pleasure speaking to you. I can't wait to see what you do next.
Pleasure. I've absolutely loved it. Absolutely loved it. Thank you so much for having me.
And you can catch up with I May Destroy You, which I thoroughly recommend. It's now on BBC iPlayer. And Gangs of London is available on Sky Atlantic, which is magnificent. But don't eat anything before you see it. If you've enjoyed this and other episodes of the podcast, I would really appreciate it if you just left a review on Apple Podcasts. As always, all the music in this episode was from Waiting for Smith. You can find him on social media, and why not listen to more of his music on Spotify. Stare at the view. I'll be headed east to find my peace where the desert feasts.